Lecture 22. Nanak and Sirhindi, Sikhism and Sufism.
Hello. Welcome to part two of Relations Between Islam and Hinduism. Muslims gained control of most of northern India in the 12th century when they established the Delhi Sultanate. Some Hindus who were living under Muslim rule converted, perhaps in order to gain more access to government positions or to Islamic education, or perhaps to avoid the special tax that was put on non-Muslims when they converted, they didn't have to pay that anymore. Or there may have been some lower caste Hindus who converted to Islam so they could escape the caste system. And undoubtedly, there were some who genuinely converted, who came to believe that Muhammad had revealed the truth about God. But accepting Islam was by no means a universal response, as was more nearly the case a few centuries later in Indonesia, which today has the world's largest Muslim population. In India, the hold of tradition was too strong, so Muslims and Hindus settled into it an uneasy coexistence. There were three ways to find a balance between the two religions. You could keep the community separate, you could allow them to merge, at least to some extent, or you could find a higher truth that transcended them both. In this lecture, we'll see all three strategies, along with two great minds, Nanak and Sirhindi. We'll start with that third model, the one with transcendence. And we'll start with Guru Nanak. He was a great poet and founder of Sikhism, and he showed this third way to God, a new religious tradition that was neither Hindu nor Muslim, though it had points in common with both. Nanak lived from 1469 to 1530. That makes him a contemporary of Martin Luther. He was born near the city of Lahore in eastern Pakistan. The region is called the Punjab, and it's now split between India and Pakistan. Nanak's family was Hindu, though his father worked as an accountant for a Muslim landlord. Nanak eventually married, had three children, and was himself employed as an administrator for a local Muslim ruler. At the age of 30, he had a profound religious experience while taking his morning bath in a stream. He disappeared for 3 days and was presumed drowned. And then he showed up again suddenly, and his first words were, "There is neither Hindu nor Muslim, so whose path should I follow? I shall follow God's path. God is neither Hindu nor Muslim." Okay, that sounds a little bit strange because there obviously are Hindus and Muslims who sometimes don't get along so well. But Nanak is saying that from some perspective, from God's perspective, that distinction that matters so much to people in India doesn't really matter at all. Nanak said that in this experience, he had been taken up to the court of God and handed a cup that was filled with nectar and then given this command. He was told, "This is the cup of the adoration of God's name. Drink it. I am with you. Go rejoice in my name and teach others to do so. I have bestowed the gift of my name upon you. Let this be your calling." So he quit his job. He said goodbye to his wife and children, and he began to wander, singing songs that he had written in praise of God with musical accompaniment provided by his Muslim traveling companion, Mardana. He went on four long journeys, this at least is the story, north up to Kashmir, east to Bengal, south as far as Sri Lanka, and then west to Baghdad, even all the way to Mecca. As he traveled, he visited both Hindu and Muslim holy sites, and he wore a combination of Hindu and Muslim clothing styles. Perhaps that was to show that his new faith was open to everyone. Nanak preached the oneness of God and the equality of all humanity. But the God that he praised, who was present in all creation, was not anthropomorphic. The Sikh scriptures begin with Nanak's famous invocation. "There is one God," he uses actually the numeral one there, "there is one God, eternal truth is his name, maker of all things, fearing nothing and at enmity with nothing. Timeless is his image, not begotten, being of his own being, by the grace of the Guru known to men." This translation, there are a lot of translations, this is notoriously difficult to translate. This one is a little bit misleading because it talks about how truth is his name, but the God of Nanak is actually without gender. He's beyond those sorts of qualities. So Nanak teaches monotheism and an equality that sort of sound like Islam, But he also denied the authority of Muhammad and the Quran. The connections with Hinduism are stronger. Nanak taught that salvation comes when the soul, after numerous cycles of reincarnation, salvation comes when the soul is finally united with God. And he drew on a long tradition of Hindu mystic bhakti poets. You may remember some of those from a couple lectures ago. Remember, these are people who say that caste doesn't matter, education doesn't matter, wealth doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is your devotion to God, whether that's Vishnu or Shiva. So in Sikhism, Nanak sort of draws on that tradition of devotion. I mean, he was called a guru, so you've got this Hindu element there. But there's a stronger rejection of idols and avatars and the Vedas and the caste system. Nanak taught a strict morality, but it was an ethic for householders. He didn't believe that asceticism or renunciation brought one closer to God, so he's a little different from a lot of Hindu holy men in that way. Instead, a person should meditate on God's name, earn an honest living, and then share with others. Free community kitchens where all people can eat together are an integral part of Sikh temples even to this day. And that's a big deal in India because, remember, in the caste system, there were strict limits about who you could and could not eat with. So Sikhism is open to everyone. And through meditating on the name of God and earning an honest living and sharing generously, one can overcome ego and anger, greed and lust and pride and attachment. Poetry can also help one draw closer to God. Here's an example of Guru Nanak's verse that I particularly like. And he's speaking to God, of course. He says, "You were the ocean, wise and clear-sighted. How shall I, the little fish, perceive your limits? Wherever I look, there you are. And if I go out from you, I burst and die." Unfortunately, a new faith that was neither Hindu nor Muslim tended to attract persecution from both, but especially from the Muslim rulers. Nanak was the first of 10 Sikh gurus, but after the martyrdom of the fifth guru in 1606, so that's about the time that the King James Bible was translated, the followers of Sikhism found it necessary to organize themselves into a strict, militarized community in order to survive. There are about 26 million Sikhs in the world today, and Sikh men are easily recognizable by their turbans that they always wear, their uncut beards, and the ceremonial daggers that they carry. Rather than having a contemporary guru, just in that line of succession, Sikhs today are directed by the Adi Granth, a collection of nearly 6,000 hymns that the 10th guru appointed as his perpetual successor in 1708. So he says there's no 11th guru, there's just the Adi Granth. That will be your guide for everything. This book includes 974 poems written by Nanak, as well as hymns from Muslim Sufis and from Hindu mystic poets. And so it includes some poems from Kabir. You may remember him from an earlier lecture. He was raised as a Muslim, and he had a Hindu guru, and he was sort of critical of both the Muslim religious authorities and the Brahmins, and he was beloved by the common people in both communities. Actually, the story is that when he died, both Hindus and Muslims claimed his body. The Hindus wanted to cremate him. The Muslims wanted to bury him. And as they were arguing, they lifted up the shroud and found only a heap of flower petals underneath. At least that's the story. Okay, so that's the transcendent option, now the merging option. And we're going to move forward in time by about a century. The Mughal Empire was a period when Muslims had unified most of India under their rule. It began in 1526, and then it lasted until 1858, when it was supplanted by the British Raj. It reached its height with the reign of Akbar the Great, and he lived from 1542 to 1605. As rulers of India, the Mughal emperors were fabulously wealthy, and they paid for a great deal of art, painting and poetry, but especially architecture. If you go to India today, you're likely to visit the Red Fort in Delhi, or the Agra Fort, or the Taj Mahal that was built by Akbar's grandson, Shah Jahan. Akbar is not going to be one of our great minds in this course. In fact, he wasn't even literate. But he was a remarkable example of pre-modern religious tolerance. It appears that early in his reign, Akbar was rather intolerant toward Hindus, but he realized that keeping the peace between Muslims and Hindus was going to be the key to ruling India. So he married a Hindu princess as a matter of diplomacy. He had other wives as well. And then he deliberately integrated Hindus into the ruling nobility, which made the Muslim nobles not all that comfortable. But Akbar was pretty set on this is the way to integrate things, to gain harmony and order in his land. Akbar abolished the traditional poll tax on non-Muslims. And lowering taxes always makes rulers more popular. And he commissioned the translation into Persian of some of the Vedas and the classic Indian epics like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. Remember that included the Bhagavad Gita. Akbar showed respect for the holy men and pilgrimage sites of all religions, and he even banned the slaughter of cows in the capital as an acknowledgement of his Hindu subjects' sensibilities. He himself committed to two-day-a-week vegetarianism. Akbar began to turn away from Orthodox Islam toward a more mystic version of the faith called Sufism, especially after a Sufi holy man correctly prophesied the birth of Akbar's son. He was distressed by the Orthodox Muslims' harsh criticism of Shia and Sufis. In 1575, Akbar built the House of Worship, a building in his palace compound, and to that building he invited scholars of many religions to come and debate spiritual matters. There were Muslim scholars, of course, but also Hindus and Jains, Sikhs and Zoroastrians, remember they're called Parsis in India. There were Roman Catholic priests and even Charvaka atheists, whom you may remember from Lecture 3. There was also a private audience hall with a rather unusual design. It had a large central pillar in it, and then there were four catwalks. They were about 8 feet in the air that extended from this pillar to each corner of the hall. And it's thought that Akbar would stride along these catwalks, listening in on conversations below and sometimes offering some questions or his own opinions just to stir things up. It's almost literally the Darshana Hotel, where everybody is arguing and discussing with each other. But by this time, the Buddhists in India are gone. Toward the end of his life, Akbar tried to start a new religion that deliberately combined the monotheism of Islam with elements of Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, Jainism, and Christianity, with himself as a divine ruler. Okay. Part of this is all of this religious fervor at the time is due to the fact that according to the Muslim calendar, the year 1000 was approaching. Okay, that's 1000 AH after the Hijra. So people were expecting exciting spiritual things to happen. Akbar's new religion never really got off the ground. We know of only 19 converts, all of them members of his court. It faded rather quickly under considerable criticism. One of those critics, in fact, would be the second great mind of this lecture, Ahmad Sirhindi, the Indian Muslim reformer who's sometimes called the renewer of the second millennium. Remember, that's the second millennium of Islam in that 1000 AH. But Sirhindi's ideas aren't going to make sense unless we back up a little bit. He comes in the middle of a long conversation that we so far haven't really been part of. We haven't been overhearing, in part because this conversation begins far to the west in Iraq, and this is the story of Sufism. Islam has rich traditions of legal analysis and government administration, but there were some who felt that precise rulings on various behaviors, you know, what you should do or what you shouldn't do, or the accumulation of political power, they thought that those were rather irrelevant to true religion, which ought to focus on the relationship of the soul to God. Sufis, and they included both men and women, pursued the goal of unity with God through devotion and mysticism. They also rejected the worldliness and the moral laxity of the Umayyad rulers of the 8th century. So the word Sufi means wool, and it refers to the plain, common fabric that was worn by those who were critical of the silks and the satins of the powerful. The Sufis practice asceticism and spiritual exercises in order to rid themselves of attachments and to experience God's love directly in what was frequently an ecstatic, joyful union in which all sense of self was forgotten. They describe it almost like being drunk, though good Muslims shouldn't know too much about that. But the idea is that you sort of get lost in this and you can't even remember the next day what exactly had happened. They wanted to develop an inner spirituality as opposed to a life that was based on outward observances of Sharia. This is the Islamic code of conduct. So the lives of Sufis were often somewhat unconventional, and they developed reputations for holiness, and they attracted dedicated followers. Early Sufis include Rabia, an Iraqi woman in the 8th century who rejected all offers of marriage in order to live a life of celibacy, poverty, and devotion. She's famous for her religious attitude that was indifferent to personal gain. Okay, this is her most famous lines here. "O God, if I worship thee in fear of hell, burn me in hell. And if I worship thee in hope of paradise, exclude me from paradise. But if I worship thee for thine own sake, withhold not thine everlasting beauty." Right, so the idea is you're not being religious because you're hoping to get into heaven or to avoid hell. If that's your motivation, she says, it's not going to work at all. Religion isn't about what's in it for me. It's about what's in it for God. Being completely, give yourself over to God entirely with no thought of self. Al-Bistami, a Persian in the 9th century, who apparently had some exposure to Hinduism, spoke of the annihilation of the self in God. He was sometimes so carried away by the intensity of his connection with God that he would burst into utterances like, "Glory be to me," or "How great is my majesty." Okay, it's a little bit dangerous, not quite as much as the next guy, who is Al-Hallaj. He's a Persian in the 10th century, and he actually spent some time in India, so we might wonder if there's some Hindu influence there. But he was known to go into trance-like states, and to say things like, "I am the truth." Okay, since the truth is one of the 99 names of God in Islam, this sounded to some people like saying, "I am God," which is clearly blasphemous. Remember, there's no God but Allah. I mean, think about what it would be like if a Christian were to say, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life." Okay, this is just going to cause problems. And indeed, it was all too much for the Orthodox authorities. Al-Hallaj was imprisoned for 8 years, and then he was tortured, mutilated, crucified, decapitated, and his body was burned. I mean, they really didn't like this guy. Although today, many Muslims revere Al-Hallaj as a martyr. The person who finally resolves this conflict is named Al-Ghazali. Because his philosophy is more directed toward the West, he doesn't quite qualify as a great mind of the Eastern intellectual tradition, but he's certainly one of the great minds of human history. Al-Ghazali lives from 1058 to 1111. He was born in Persia. His father and one of his brothers were Sufis, but he showed more talent for philosophy, theology, and jurisprudence. Just a brilliant student. At the age of 34, he was appointed to a very prestigious professorship at a Baghdad university. He taught for 4 years, and then, at the end of that period, he had something of a spiritual crisis when he realized that religious truth couldn't conclusively be determined by logic and reason. Okay, and this is somebody who knows all about logic and reason. So Al-Ghazali renounces his career, and he began to travel as a Sufi. He wandered for more than a decade, and then returned to his hometown and spent the rest of his life alternating periods of teaching with times of seclusion and meditation. And he wrote over 70 books. Al-Ghazali's was a radical skepticism. It's sometimes compared to that of Descartes. And he was critical of four groups. He was critical of Sufi mystics who don't keep Sharia, right, who break all of the law or some of the important laws of Islam. He was critical of authoritarian Shia who appealed to their religious leaders. He was critical of theologians who tried to base their ideas on axioms rather than on faith. And he was critical of philosophers, even though he himself is a philosopher. Against this last group, he wrote a famous book called The Incoherence of the Philosophers, in which he attacked Muslim thinkers who had been so heavily influenced by Greek philosophers that they rejected the doctrines of creation and a literal bodily resurrection. Right? They believed, along with Aristotle, they were influenced there, that the world was eternal. And he said, no, it's really important that God is a creator. And they were also influenced by Plato, who thought that, you know, if you could just escape the limitations of the body and go into the world of ideal forms, that would be better. Why would you want a body back after you had died? And he says, no, physical, literal resurrection is an essential part of Islam. But Al-Ghazali wasn't the kind of person to just yell heresy and then declare the debate over. He was a philosopher, and so he carefully demonstrated that the philosophical arguments of the people he was attacking were inconsistent and invalid based on their own assumptions. But having shown that rational arguments would never lead to religious certainty, he then suggested that Sufism could offer a direct knowledge of God. Okay, it's something like Nagarjuna with Madhyamaka Buddhism. Do you remember that he has his tetralemma where he's going to show that any assertions about reality are going to lead to contradiction and error? And so because you can't do philosophy in that way, the alternative is to go to meditation. Okay, Al-Ghazali does something similar to that. He says, when God takes care of the heart, the mystery of the spiritual realm is revealed and the veil of error vanishes. Al-Ghazali taught that a Sufism that kept within the bounds of Sharia, right, that kept those sort of basic commandments, and avoided the extremes of Al-Halaj, who said those wild kinds of things, that kind of Sufism might be perfectly in harmony with Orthodox Islam. It's sort of a difference between sober Sufism, sort of that's reasonable and moderate, versus drunken Sufism, where people go into these, you know, wild states and say all kinds of amazing things. Which is all to say that Al-Ghazali makes Sufism respectable in Islam. Now, we might tie this to something that you probably already heard about. You may have heard of a Sufi mystic named Rumi. He was a 13th century Persian, and he wrote a love poetry that's gotten a lot of attention in recent years. It's really lovely kind of stuff, all about one yearning for one's beloved and the sorrow of separation. I'm not sure people who recite or pass around those poems today realize that those poems are all addressed to God, right? That this is an analogy of romantic human love is used to express the deeper truths of spiritual love for God. Eventually, Rumi settled in Turkey, and his followers formed a Sufi school that's sometimes known as the Whirling Dervishes, where they spin around and around as they enter into a state where they commune with God. Okay, but what does all this have to do with India? Sufism, with its mystical experience, its direct access to God, its emphasis on love rather than strict rules, it had tremendous appeal to ordinary Indians. Just as Buddhists in China found common ground with Taoists, Sufis could talk with Hindus. I mean, the asceticism and the meditation were familiar, and the intense devotion reminded Hindus of things that they knew in their own culture. It reminded them of the similar devotion that they had to saints. They share these things. And there's an expression of religious sentiment in both Sufism and Hindu culture through dance and music and poetry. So Sufis were detached, but they remain in the world, often working for justice in their communities. It's a little bit like Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. Remember that he's detached. Karma yoga is the way that he acts. But he still is able to defend his people and fight on their behalf and stuff. The idea of union with the divine seems a lot like Vedanta philosophy of Shankara. And the Sufi path to God, it's in several stages, and different Sufi authors have different lists of what those stages are. But there's just there's an organized, regular, systematic path. That kind of thing seems similar to yoga with its eight limbs, as you remember. And even Al-Biruni, earlier on, recognized this connection, or at least the parallels between the Sufi path and the path of yoga. What success Islam had in India was to a considerable extent due to Sufis. Yet on the other hand, the mixing of traditions threatened to get out of control when Islamic practices were combined with local Hindu cults and beliefs. Which brings us back to Ahmad Sirhindi at the court of Akbar. Sirhindi lived from 1564 to 1624. He was a Sufi master who challenged the mixing of Islam and Hinduism that he saw in Akbar's new religion. He was also concerned about the growing acceptance of an idea called the unity of being, which goes back to a Spanish philosopher named Ibn Arabi. Sirhindi saw this idea, this unity of being, as basically a form of monism, right? God is absolute reality and the only thing that exists, and all beings are, therefore, in some sense, God. The existence of the universe is just God's way of contemplating himself. Okay, Sirhindi is uncomfortable with this teaching, which he believed denied the critical separation between creator and creation. It also makes evil a problem? Because if everything is part of God, then evil is part of God, and that's an unpleasant, uncomfortable sort of thing to think about. So Sirhindi wanted to replace this idea of the unity of being with the unity of experience. The world and God are two different things, though Sufis may subjectively perceive them as the same. But this is a perception. It's not reality. It may be like a lover who thinks that his beloved is the most beautiful woman in the world or the most handsome man. Okay, objectively, maybe not so. But it is something that you might genuinely think when you're caught up in true love. Sirhindi wrote that the overwhelming power of the vision of the unity of God is such that it's impossible to see what's beyond the state of annihilation of the self. Well, we need to talk about this. All right. So when Al-Hallaj said, "I am the true," or Al-Bastami exclaimed, "Praise be to me," they were accurately describing their own subjective experience, but that's something that happens in their minds, not in reality. It's like, and here's his analogy. It's probably better than my analogy. His analogy is, it's like how the stars disappear when the sun comes out. It's not that the stars don't continue to exist independently. It's just that they become imperceptible in the glorious light. So his position is something like Madhva's dualism, though the two thinkers don't seem to have influenced each other at all. Right? So when you're caught up in this glorious vision, a lot of distinctions that are really there seem to disappear. Sirhindi insisted that individual purification and spiritual realization must begin with Orthodox Islam, and he discouraged music and dancing and trance states. Instead, he said, the Sufi path should feature the calm and focused recitation of the names of God under the guidance of a Sufi master. Okay. In all these ways, Sirhindi set clear boundaries between Islam and Hinduism, and his favored school of Sufism, called Naqshbandi, became dominant in India. As Sirhindi once wrote, Muslims should follow their religion and non-Muslims their ways. We know about Sirhindi's ideas not because he wrote, you know, some massive book about all of this. He actually wrote letters, and that's how we know what he thought. But there are lots of them. There are 536 of his letters have survived. In some ways, it's too bad we don't have a lot of time to talk about the 700 miracles that were attributed to Sirhindi, starting with his being born circumcised, sort of an anatomical marvel that also appears in the Talmud. It's attributed to some of the great prophets. Or the way that his disciples recorded the minute details of his daily life, I mean, down to the way that he brushed his teeth, so that they could imitate Sirhindi in every way as their Sufi master. And in some ways, this is a little bit like the way that Hindus talk about their saints, and they're very committed. Muslim Sufis are very committed to their Sufi masters. All right, so how have these three approaches to balancing Hinduism and Islam fared? Sikhism, the transcendent model, is still a vibrant religion. And though its numbers are relatively small, it's successfully crossed cultural divides, and it's now flourishing in Europe and in America. Sirhindi's attempts to keep the Muslim and Hindu communities distinct and separate was very influential even in later centuries with the creation of Pakistan, as we'll see in Lecture 30 when we talk about Muhammad Iqbal. Sirhindi is still remembered as a valiant reformer who was unwilling to compromise his faith and who kept the integrity of Islam in India secure. And then the third model is this mixing of traditions, which is quietly continued, particularly the further one gets from Mecca. For instance, Indonesia is a thoroughly Muslim country, but they have also been influenced by Hindu traditions. Sufism was important in the Islamicization of Indonesia as well, as Sufi missionaries and mystics went there and impressed common people with their devotion and their kindness. And many people responded by converting. But that sort of Islam in Indonesia was of the looser, more accommodating variety that Sirhindi warned against. So Indonesians today, they're Muslim, but they still love the Hindu epics of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And they have this great tradition of shadow puppets as they act these out. In fact, the American president, Barack Obama, who is Christian, but he grew up in Indonesia, and he's talked about how much he loved watching those puppet shows of the Mahabharata as a boy. The Indonesian national airline is named Garuda, which is the name of the mythical bird on which the god Vishnu rides. So Indonesia is a place, certainly Muslim, but where cultures have mixed as well.